Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Thursday, April 11. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, Iowa women's basketball holds end-of-year celebration. This story by John Steppe. Barbara Wilson summed up Iowa fans' love of the 2023-24 women's basketball team perfectly in front of 8,000-plus fans at Carver-Hawkeye Arena. Simply, you bring out the best in everyone, the University of Iowa president said to the team at Wednesday's end-of-the-season celebration. Countless people want to be like you. They want to be around you. It also was clear on a night when athletics director Beth Getz announced plans to retire Caitlin Clark's number 22, what will be only the third retired number in the program history. One of the biggest cheers on Wednesday evening came when Getz told senior captain Kate Martin, who has coaching ambitions, "There is an office open when you're ready for me to hire you." Allison Stevenson, a relatively new women's basketball fan from Mason City, who was at the celebration, said she loves watching them playing together, but it's more than just them playing. They're really positive role models, Stevenson said. They appear to be best friends on the court, off the court. What they've done to elevate not only women's basketball, but women's sports. Nate Johnson, 42, of Urbana, brought his two boys to Wednesday's event. One boy's favorite Hawkeye is Gabby Marshall, and the other's is Clark. Johnson wanted to show his two children that it's important to have role models, to appreciate those role models, to honor those role models, and hopefully grow the next generation who will be role models. Seeing how Caitlin always takes time for the kids is important, Johnson said of Iowa's star player, who stayed several minutes after the program was over to sign as many autographs as possible. They need to see that. If they make it to that level, it's important to engage with the young ones. Stevenson went to almost all of Iowa's 2023-24 games, although her husband Kent is quick to note none of them were regular price. "Some people go to Puerto Vallarta for spring break," said Stevenson, who held a sign offering snacks to Clark's father in exchange for Clark's autograph. "We spent our money and came to Carver-Hawkeye." The Stevensons, who have grandchildren in Cedar Rapids, left Cedar Rapids at 11:30 a.m. on Saturday morning and drove to Cleveland for the national championship. "It was spontaneous. The most spontaneous thing we've done in the 40 years we've been married together," Kent Stevenson chimed in. Teresa Hobbs from Iowa City has similarly been dedicated this season after not being much of a women's basketball fan before the last 2 years. "The university was giving away free tickets last year for employees, so I took them up on it," Hobbs said. "This year, we ended up getting season tickets. It was the team. It was fun to watch." Clark will be gone, presumably, to the Indiana Fever, which has the first pick in next week's WNBA draft. But fans like Hobbs, Johnson, and the Stevenson couple aren't going anywhere. "If we could even get in the door, we'll definitely go to several games," Johnson said. Also on the front page today, this article by Aaron Jordan, "New PFAS Limits, Lauded for Public Health but Costly for Water Systems." New federal rules for toxic chemicals in drinking water could lead to costly upgrades for more than a dozen Iowa communities that have tested high for PFAS in the past. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency on Wednesday released the first national drinking water limit on PFAS, or perfluoroquil and polyfluoroquil substances, a family of industrial chemicals dubbed forever chemicals because of how long they can last in the body and the environment. Officials say this will reduce exposure for 100 million people and help prevent thousands of illnesses, including cancers. "Everyone can agree we need to get these things out of our water," said David Courtney, a University of Iowa engineering professor and director for the Center of Health Effects of Environmental Contamination. "We're still understanding health effects, but what we know is not good." PFAS has been used for decades in products including nonstick pans, firefighting foam, and waterproof clothing. Although some of the most common types are phased out in the United States, others remain. Water providers will now be forced to remove contamination put in the environment by other industries. The new rules set a limit of 4 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFOS, 2 common types of contaminants. 3 other types that include Gen X chemicals are limited to 10 parts per trillion. Within 5 years, water providers will have to test for these chemicals and tell the public when levels are too high. Combinations of some types will be limited too. We've got a lot of communities that are going to need to figure out how to address this, he said. The Iowa DNR started testing community water supplies for chemicals in 2021. Results available online show 14 water systems, including cities and mobile home parks, whose water tested over 4 parts per trillion. In other places, PFAS were detected, but below the threshold. In many other places, including Iowa City and Cedar Rapids, PFAS were not found in the public water supply. Central City in North Linn County stopped using one well in 2022 after chemical levels of 60 parts per trillion were found there, the Iowa Capital Dispatch reported. Comanche, a town along the Mississippi River, is digging 2 new deep wells after PFAS were found at high levels in drinking water. As part of an agreement with the EPA, 3M, which manufactured PFAS at the nearby Cordova, Illinois plant, has agreed to pay $800,000 to help fix the city's chemical pollution. Cities with high levels will need to find a new water supply or install a new purification system, such as reverse osmosis, Hortney said. It's going to be extra challenging when a large number of water systems are trying to do the same things at the same time, he said, adding that the EPA also has asked cities to remove lead service lines within 10 years. Our water systems have their hands full. Although there is money available for these upgrades, it may not be enough. If you choose reverse osmosis, there's a huge upfront capital cost. But there are ongoing costs, Courtney said. For communities that have this issue, folks will look at a rate increase as a viable way forward. Utility groups warn the rules will cost tens of billions of dollars each and fall hardest on small communities with fewer resources. Legal challenges are sure to follow. EPA Administrator Michael Reagan says the rule is the most important action the EPA has ever taken on PFAS. The result is a comprehensive and life-changing rule, one that will improve the health and vitality of so many communities across our country, said Reagan. And the final story on the front page, 900,000 plan to feed kids after 25 million offer axed. This story by Aaron Murphy for the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. More than 3 months after turning down $29 million in federal funding for low-income families to spend on food for their school-aged children in the summer, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds announced Wednesday a $900,000 grant program with similar goals. In December, Reynolds announced the state will not participate in the federal summer EBT program, which provides low-income families with $40 per month in benefits over 3 months. That program started during the COVID-19 pandemic emergency and now is being made permanent. It was designed to provide free meals in the summer months to students from low-income families who receive free or reduced-price meals during the school year. States were given the option of remaining in the program. Iowa was among 17 states, nearly all with Republican governors, that declined. Reynolds at the time said she believed the program was not sustainable and did not promote nutrition. The new state grant program is being funded by federal pandemic relief funds. It is designed to create additional summer meal sites that will serve more children in currently underserved areas across the state, the governor's office said in a news release. Providing young Iowans with access to free, nutritious meals in their communities during the summer months has always been a priority, Reynolds said in a statement. With the summer meal program expansion grant, We will expand these well-established programs across our state to ensure Iowa's youth have meals that are healthy and use local community farms and vendors when possible. The number of eligible applicants and their proposals will determine the number and amount of grants awarded across the state, the governor's office said. The grants will help school districts and other qualified organizations expand participation in two current federal summer child nutrition programs, the Summer Food Service Program and Seamless Summer Option. Those programs are administered by the Iowa Department of Education in partnership with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Qualifying schools can participate in either federal program, and private nonprofit organizations, community and faith-based organizations, higher education institutions, and local government agencies will be eligible to participate in the Summer Food Service Program, the governor's office said. New meal sites must be located in an area where at least 50% of the children are eligible for free or reduced price meals. The meals can be served at schools, churches, parks, libraries, and other public spaces, according to the governor's office. Luke Elzinga, board chair of the Iowa Hunger Coalition, said the daily average participation at summer meal sites in Iowa in 2023 was 21,557, which is less than 10% of the more than 245,000 Iowa children who would have received the $40 per month from the summer EBT that Reynolds rejected. While we certainly welcome the new grant program to expand summer meal sites, we also recognize that barriers will remain for families to access those sites. Summer EBT is meant to complement, not replace, summer feeding sites, Elzinga said in a statement. We truly hope this grant program increases access to nutritious food for low-income kids during the summer, but the fact remains that our governor chose to deny $29 million in federal funds that would go directly to low-income families with children who face additional financial struggles during the summer months when kids are out of school. The statement continued. Under the new state grant program, priority will be given to applicants seeking to establish a new meal site and to schools or organizations that did not participate in the federal programs last year or are in a county with two or fewer meal sites. Schools and organizations can apply for reimbursement funding up to $10,000 for the first new site and $5,000 for each additional site, up to a total of $20,000 for current program sponsors and $30,000 for new sponsors. Through partnerships with community-based providers and schools, the Summer Meal Program Expansion Grant will build upon family-focused solutions to support child nutrition and well-being in the summer, Iowa Department of Education Director Mackenzie Snow said in a statement. The Iowa Department of Education remains committed to supporting students with healthy meals and food options, as it supports communities in growing the impact of existing child nutrition programs. State House Democrats continued Wednesday to express their disappointment that Reynolds declined the larger federal program. While I appreciate the governor finally doing something for hungry children in our state, the competitive grant program announced today amounts to crumbs for Iowa kids, Senator Sarah Trone Garrio, a Democrat from West Des Moines, said in a statement. Governor Reynolds could have accepted $29 million in federal food assistance that would have reached 240,000 children in every corner of the state. The $900,000 state program she announced today is tiny by comparison and forces Iowa communities to compete for a sliver of that much smaller pie. It's not enough to meet the meal needs facing our state, and it doesn't make up for her decision to let Iowa kids go hungry. Trone Garrio and Elzinger said the new state program does not account for some barriers to low-income families getting help from food assistance programs, like a lack of transportation to get to meal sites or who live in areas without meal sites. While summer feeding programs have their place, they are not accessible to all Iowa families, Trone Garrio said. Families must bring their children to and from the site every day, which is impossible for most working families. There are many Iowa school districts and entire counties that don't even have a feeding site. As a result, these programs assisted less than 20,000 children last year. The governor could have expanded these programs and participated in the summer EBT program, but instead she put politics before the health and well-being of our kids. Applications for the new state program are being accepted at iowagrants.gov through May 7. Turning now to the Iowa Today page, Muslim community observes Eid el-Fitr in Cedar Rapids. Ali Juma greets people as they enter during the Islamic Center of Cedar Rapids Eid el-Fitr celebration Wednesday at Game On Sports in Cedar Rapids. The holiday of breaking fast is the celebration to mark the end of the month-long dawn until dusk fasting of Ramadan. And that article includes several photos of those folks who gathered. Also on the Iowa Today page, a body found in Benton County believed to be missing teen. This by Emily Anderson. A body found in a wrecked car is likely that of a Benton County teenager missing since March 31, authorities said Wednesday. Xander McClintock, age 18, was last seen in Marion on March 31st at about 11:30 p.m. and was reportedly traveling to Van Horn. Benton County deputies on Tuesday found McClintock's vehicle, a black 2004 Chevrolet Cavalier, about 5 miles south of Vinton in Benton County, with human remains at the scene, according to a news release from the sheriff's office. Benton County Sheriff Ronald Tippett said that while the body has not yet been officially identified, investigators have no reason to believe it isn't that of McClintock. Initial investigation indicates there was a car crash and foul play is not suspected, the release stated. The death is being investigated by the Benton County Sheriff's Office, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, the State Fire Marshal, and the State Medical Examiner. In other Iowa news, Cedar Rapids fire and police investigate arson at Men's Room Barbershop, this by Emily Anderson. The Cedar Rapids Police and Fire Departments are investigating an arson at a Cedar Rapids barbershop Wednesday morning. Cedar Rapids firefighters were called to 1501 First Avenue Southeast at 2:30 a.m. Wednesday. No one was in the building at the time of the fire, and firefighters quickly extinguished it, according to a news release from the fire department. Fire investigators have since determined that the fire was an arson and that incendiary devices were used, according to the department. A Facebook post from the barbershop, the Men's Room Hair and Beard Parlor, states that a couple of windows were broken and someone had thrown several Molotov cocktails into the building. Fortunately, the fire department was called right away before too much was burned. We're hoping to be opened back up by Friday morning. Very saddening that someone wanted us gone that badly that they would do this, the post states. The fire remains under investigation and no arrests have been made. In this AP story, judge blocks demo of outdoor art installation. A federal judge has temporarily blocked plans to remove a nationally known outdoor artwork that borders a pond in a Des Moines city park, finding the New York artist who created the work is likely to succeed in her argument that destroying the work would violate her contract with a local art center. U.S. District Court Judge Stephen Locher ordered the temporary restraining order Monday afternoon after hearing arguments earlier in the day about the Des Moines Art Center's plans to remove the artwork called Greenwood Pond Double Site. The center had planned to begin a roughly 3-month process of draining the pond and tearing out the artwork this week. Officials at the art center say the work, which was completed in 1996, has deteriorated beyond repair and is hazardous to park visitors. The artwork offers different perspectives of Greenwood Pond, including wooden decks over the water and walkways that let people see the water and wetlands at eye level and from above. The work is seen as a highlight of land artist Mary Miss. Other artists and arts organizations across the country have expressed outrage about plans to remove the installation rather than try to raise money for repairs. Miss has argued the Art Center hasn't kept her informed about the work she created and would violate a contract that requires the wood, concrete, and metal artwork to be maintained and not removed without her permission. I am pleased and relieved by Judge Locher's decision, not only for what it has done for Greenwood Pond Double Site, but because it reaffirms the rights of all artists and the integrity of their legacies, Miss said in a statement. Let's use this opportunity to reach an outcome of which we can all be proud. Art Center officials, who have estimated it would cost $2.6 million to repair the artwork, said public safety was its top concern, but it would abide by the court-ordered pause. Much of the artwork now is surrounded by fencing. We respect the court's decision, and we will be pausing plans to remove the artwork from Greenwood Park, the Art Center said in a statement. The sections declared dangerous and unsalvageable will remain enclosed in protective fencing. The judge will set a hearing later for Miss's request for a preliminary injunction to continue a delay to demolition plans while the dispute works through the courts. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from Sunday's Washington Post. Women's basketball is having its Michael Jordan moment. Women's college basketball has become a cultural phenomenon. Arenas are selling out. Records have been set for Division I all-time college points, three-pointers, and TV viewership. Women's Final Four tickets have been reselling for double the men's tickets. The top players are now household names. Iowa's Caitlin Clark, Louisiana State University's Angel Reese, the University of Connecticut's Paige Bookers, the University of Southern California's Juju Watkins, the University of South Carolina's Camila Cardoso, to name a few. But the images of young girls and boys begging for autographs, crying when they meet players, have been the most evocative. For decades, women's professional sports have been a cultural afterthought, with vast differences in pay and player treatment relative to men's team, justified by middling interest, though passionate, among the public. That could change. This moment feels akin to that of the 1990s Chicago Bulls with Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, or when soccer star Brandi Chastain won the World Cup for Team USA and ripped off her shirt. And it has been a long time coming. Many of the coaches of Elite Eight teams had to beg friends to attend their games, which they played in rotting facilities that men's teams had long abandoned. Title IX, a 1972 federal law, mandated more equality between men's and women's college sports. The early 2000s saw players such as Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird, who generated many TV viewers in college with their faster game and then went on to elevate the WNBA's stature. Now women's basketball is reaching new heights. There's already buzz about next year's college season, with the return of players such as Watkins and LSU's Flora Johnson. Meanwhile, the WNBA is about to welcome the once-in-a-generation talents of Clark and Reese, who could start selling out professional stadiums next year, too. South Carolina won the title Sunday night in Cleveland, capping an epic season with a trophy and ring. But every women's college basketball player in the tournament this year has been part of something greater than March Madness. They gave kids something to literally aim for. And the 24-hour Doorman column today is titled, Misguided Bill Would Tax Forests. It seems like a bad time to be anti-tree. We're not quite 4 years removed from a derecho which, according to the Department of Natural Resources, destroyed 724,000 acres of the state's forests. That's out of 2.9 million forested acres total, according to the USDA. Clearly, the state's woodlands took a beating at the hands of a fierce storm. Now, the Republican-controlled Iowa legislature is considering a bill that would do further damage. Under current law, forest reservations of at least 2 acres and 200 trees per acre are exempted from property taxes. It's an incentive for landowners to preserve wooded areas along with their environmental benefits. But House File 2672, a bill that has passed the Iowa House and is moving through the Iowa Senate, would allow counties to decide whether they provide the forest exemption, and the size of an eligible woodland would increase from 2 acres to 5 acres. So, counties could drop their exemption. Some woodlands currently exempted would lose that status. Who would want to provide a disincentive for landowners to keep forests? The Iowa Cattlemen's Association, the Iowa Corn Growers Association, the Iowa Soybean Association, and of course, the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation are all registered in favor of the bill. Farm groups want more land for grazing and crop production. Lose the tax incentive and landowner could be persuaded to sell the land for farming. The Farm Bureau has pushed hard in recent years to make it tougher or even impossible for landowners to sell or donate their land for conservation. The Farm Bureau also opposes the expansion of parks and other public lands accessible to Iowans, arguing the state can't afford to maintain its current parks. Lowball parks budgets proposed by the governor and DNR are making sure the Farm Bureau is right, but when developers grab valuable farmland for suburban sprawl, we don't hear a peep. We provide endless tax breaks for business developments. By the way, 30.5 million acres of land in Iowa is used by farming operations. Apparently, it's not enough. Also, counties need more revenue. Then there's the local animosity toward out-of-state owners who use forested land for hunting and get a tax break. But we have a lot to lose. Trees anchor erodible land so it doesn't wash into waterways, improving water quality and helping mitigate flooding. Woodlands provide wildlife habitat, and then there's the whole absorption of carbon dioxide thing. And natural beauty, don't forget that. Think of those autumn leaves. Growing up, I was lucky to live in a forested rural area. There are woodlands along the nearby Iowa River, and about 280 acres of forest bordered our property. The woods were our playground as kids, hiking around, having adventures, and dragging our sleds through the woods to conquer Suicide Hill. And I've seen the twisted, shattered remnants of trees destroyed in the derecho. We take forested areas for granted until they're gone. This is a misguided, short-sighted bill that should be tossed into a chipper. It will do us more good as mulch. Turning now to the community letters today, the first is titled, More Positive Immigration Coverage is Needed. Finally, we received some positive media coverage on the immigrant population in the U.S. In his recent column, Bridge Disaster Humanizes Immigrants, Leon Krause emphasizes the positive daily and essential impacts immigrants have on our economy and society. We should not need reminding that immigrant labor underpins and is a major driver of the U.S. economy in agriculture, construction, and other sectors. That is true right here in Iowa, where the Iowa Business Council, in a new report, extolled the need to recruit new Iowans into our state. We need more reporting that takes politics and fear-mongering out of immigration and instead focuses on the benefits of this population and solutions for welcoming and integrating them into our communities and workforce. That letter today is signed by Jane Shuttleworth of Iowa City. The next letter is titled, Cancer Series Shows Why More Research is Needed. I applaud you for your excellent feature articles on how cancer victims in Iowa can be found in pockets and how more research is desperately needed. I live in Iowa City on the east side. My neighborhood is close to Procter & Gamble, as well as other industries who are manufacturing plastics. Within a two-block radius, two neighbors have suffered from breast cancer, stage 4 stomach cancer, and two have died from pancreatic cancer and brain cancer. These victims are only the ones I personally know about. More research needs to be done, not just in rural areas, but industrial zones too. I hope your team will do serious follow-ups on your insight into Iowa's tragic fame of being number 2 in the nation, not in women's basketball, but in cancer. And that letter today is signed by Corrine Stanley from Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette today on IRIS. Today is Thursday, April 11. Now we turn to today's obituary page, beginning with the short notices. First, in Decorah, Anita Lansing, age 98, died Tuesday, April 9. Helms Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Marion, Jean R. Hines, 85, died Tuesday, April 9, Iowa cremation. In Olwine, Frank M. Odekirk, 95, died Tuesday, April 9, Jameson Schmidt's funeral home. And in Postville, Mary Ann Cleave, age 68, died Friday, April 5. Shudi Graw Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting. Turning now to the regular notices, first in Cedar Rapids, Peter Sean Hoy, age 65, passed away Sunday, April 7, at his home. A visitation will be held from 3 to 5 on Saturday, April 13, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Peter was born February 27, 1959, to Bernard and Patricia Davis Hoy in Cedar Rapids. He proudly served in the U.S. Army. Peter gave over 35 years of service to the City of Cedar Rapids Streets Department. Online condolences can be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. Memorials may be directed to the family. From Dysart, Inez Marie Lockhard Zanner, age 76, passed away at her home from an extended illness January 25, 2024, with her devoted husband Alan and beloved kitties by her side. She was a cherished wife, mother, stepmother, grandmother, great-grandmother, aunt, cousin, and friend. Inez was born on December 23, 1947, in Vinton, the daughter of Earl and Marjorie Hayes Lockhart. She had multiple talents to tout, but her accomplishments in basketball brought her immense pride. Because of her jump shot, she was the 51st all-time leading scorer in Iowa girls' 6-on-6 history. She remained a lifelong basketball fan and enjoyed watching games with her husband. A celebration of life service will be held on Saturday, April 13th at the Dysart United Methodist Church at 10:30 a.m. Visitation will be for 30 minutes prior to the service. Burial will follow at Geneseo Church Cemetery. A luncheon will be served at the Dysart United Methodist Church following the burial. From Victor, Nancy A. Wilson, age 68, passed away April 7 at the University of Iowa Hospital in Iowa City. A funeral service will be held at 4:30 p.m. Friday, April 12, at Smith Funeral Home in Victor. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, April 11, at the Smith Funeral Home in Victor. Memorials may be designated to Joseph Wilcox, mailed in care of Smith Funeral Home, P.O. Box 368, Grinnell, Iowa, 50112. Please see smithfh.com for a full obituary. In Iowa City, James, known as Jim McPherson, age 93, formerly of Montana, died Wednesday, April 3, at Oak Knoll Retirement Residence in Iowa City. Jim was born June 16, 1930, in Port Washington, New York, to parents James William and Eleanor Doramus Jacoby McPherson. After completing his freshman year of college at Cornell University, Jim moved to Bozeman, Montana, where he finished his engineering degree at Montana State University. In 2014, Jim moved to Iowa City to be closer to family. A memorial service will be held in Montana at a later date. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Oak Knoll Foundation to benefit the music and recreational therapy programs at Oak Knoll. In Marion, Janice C. DeVries, age 82, died Monday, April 8th at St. Luke's Hospital following an extended illness. Visitation will be held from 5 until 7 Thursday, April 11th at the Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa. There will be private family graveside services at the Green Center Cemetery in Morley. Thoughts, memories, and condolences may be left at GetchOnline.com. In Cedar Rapids, Ruth, known as Nancy Waybill, age 87, of Aikens, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died Tuesday, April 9, in St. Luke's Hospital. Her wishes are cremation with no services. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Nancy was born on August 23, 1936, in Iowa City, the daughter of Ori and Lois Chapel. She grew up in Cedar Rapids and graduated from McKinley High School in 1954 and from the first class of practical nursing at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids in 1958. She worked in many positions in the medical field for some 40 years. Memorials may be directed to the family. Turning now to the sports page, this high school golf story by K.J. Pilcher, Liberty backing up potential. Iowa City Liberty coach Brian Wernemott realized that his team had promise in the preseason. The Lightning proved his assessment correct. Unlimited potential with about 20 brand new kids, Wernemott told the Gazette. It does take a long time to get good, but we definitely have some potential in new players. Liberty won its opening quadrangular of the season and finished runner-up to Cedar Rapids, Washington at a Mississippi Valley Conference quadrangular Tuesday at the Meadows Golf Club in Dubuque. The Lightning's Isabella Peterson claimed medalist honors in both meets, carding 38 on Tuesday. Good start is certainly helped by having one of the best players in the state leading the way, Wernemont said. A couple other seniors, a steady sophomore and junior combo, plus two freshmen in the mix, have us off to a good start. The Lightning ranked 21st among all classes, with a 190.6 combined adjusted average. They climbed to 12th in 4A only. Liberty finished first at Airport National, shooting 164 and winning by 31 strokes. They followed with 188 on Tuesday, 19 back of the Warriors. Pedersen led the way with 38.5 CAA, Claire Franzwa 50.15, Leona Rupp 50.65, and Sydney Hested 52.65 round out the top four, while Ella Burns and Layla Langseth close out the lineup. We were able to get a lot of the young players and new players some swings over the winter by having Pin Seekers and Tiffin open, Wernemont said. The open gyms gave them lots of swings they otherwise may not have had access to. Pedersen remains to be the Lightning's leader. She placed third at the 2021 and 22 4A state meets and is two-time MVC Mississippi Division Player of the Year. Pedersen is off to a strong start despite still healing from double hip surgery last summer. She just won't let herself fail, said Wernemont, noting a conflict with a previously scheduled appointment will keep from a rescheduled meet on Thursday. Even though her swing is still trying to be recreated after her surgery, she finds a way to shoot good scores and so far has been able to come out on top. The Crandic meet is one of the highlights of the girls' golf season, the annual event that pits the Cedar Rapids, Marion, and Iowa City high schools will be held April 17th at Twin Pines Golf Course in Cedar Rapids. The event features three top 14 teams among all classes. Linmar is fifth in team combined adjusted average at 173.1. Washington is 11th with 183.6, and Xavier is 14th at 185.2. The individual race includes Lions' 4A state champion Morgan Rupp and the Warriors' state runner-up Jane Peterson. They are joined by past top 10 state meet finishers Pedersen at 4A and Xavier's sister duo Mira and Mihar Julka, who accomplished it in 3A. Linmar is the defending team champions. The boys' golf team at Washington ranks among the 3A leaders. The Demons are third in 3A with a 157.4 combined adjusted average. Defending state champion Roman Roth fired 34 for medalist honors in Monday's meet at the Elks Fairview Golf Course in Keokuk. In boys basketball, City High hires McTaggart as the boys' head coach, this by Jeff Johnson. The guy definitely knows about winning. at this school, too. It'll be interesting to see if that translates to coaching a different gender. Iowa City High announced Tuesday that Bill McTaggart will lead its boys' basketball program. That's pending school board approval. McTaggart amassed a 427-130 record in 23 seasons as the head girls' coach of the Little Hawks. That included 12 state tournament appearances, a 2008 state championship, and 14 Mississippi Valley Conference titles, 8 in a row, from 2013 to 2020. McTaggart stepped down from his post in 2022. He remained a social study teacher at the school. I'm very excited and looking forward to the challenge of taking over our boys' basketball program, McTaggart said in a news release from City High. City High has a very special place in my heart, and I'm energized to get our arena rockin'. McTaggart did coach boys basketball before coming to City High, compiling a 91-61 record in 7 combined seasons at Rio Hondo and San Perlita High Schools in Texas. He replaces Brennett Swazer. City High went 6-16 this past season. Our search was extensive, but in the end, we just needed to walk up to the second floor, City High Activities Director Phil Lala said in a news release. Bill is a winner. He's a Little Hawk through and through, and he's ready to energize this program. His experience and steady hand is what our program needs at this point in time. We're looking forward to our basketball program taking a big step forward under his leadership. Sports of area interest today in girls soccer. Jefferson is at City High at 4:15. Liberty is at Dubuque Hempstead at 4:15. In boys soccer, Washington is at Kennedy Co. at 4 p.m. Bettendorf at Regina at 5 p.m. In girls tennis, Liberty is at Prairie, City High at Xavier, Iowa City West is at Linmar, Washington at Waterloo West, Jefferson at Cedar Falls, and Marion is at the Comanche Triangular. In boys tennis, Xavier at City High, Linmar is at Iowa City West, Prairie is at Liberty, Cedar Falls is at Jefferson, and Waterloo West is at Washington. Marion plays at Independence. In girls golf, Jefferson and City High are at Washington, playing at the Twin Pines Golf Course at 3:15. And in boys golf, Marion is at Solon, playing at Lake McBride. In high school track, Xavier, Prairie, Regina at Benton Community Invitational, and Marion is at Western Dubuque's Invitational. That's a girls' meet at 4:15. Turning to the Things to Do column today, music, Crazy Train, the number one Ozzy Osbourne tribute, hosted by Vinnie Cormier, Ozzy impersonator. Crazy Train delivers a captivating show musically and visually. The show is packed with special effects, performing a set list that covers every era of Ozzy's career. That's showing today at the Ideal Theater and Bar in Cedar Rapids at 7 p.m. Cost is $25 to $40. In the theater category, The Lady from the Sea is about a woman in 19th century Norway living a safe and secure life with a loving family who is haunted by the memory of more exciting times. When a stranger tempts her with the chance to return to those times, she is faced with an impossible choice. That shows today at the Coe College Dow's Fine Arts Center at 7:30 p.m., and the cost is $15. Turning to the Hoopla section, this story by Elijah Desius is titled Serving Up 15 Years of Diversity Visibility. Coe's International Banquet celebrates a golden milestone. For 50 years, Coe College has been offering students and the public something faster than any international commercial flight available today. Their international club can't promise you a trip around the world in 80 days, the way Jules Verne envisioned when he penned his popular novel in 1872. But since 1974, it's managed to take the community through dozens of countries without ever leaving campus. This year's trip on April 7 touched down in more than a dozen countries over 3 hours. Like most big trips, it took a lot of planning. To serve hundreds of people every year, organizers start preparations several months in advance. For the 50th milestone, students Tan Tran and Oyen Adiyawi started their work last semester. Students may not be the best cooks or have the biggest kitchens in their dorm rooms, but each spring they transform into chefs to convey their culture to the masses. This annual banquet made a buffet meal with 5 appetizers from Liberia, Ghana, Brazil, Italy, and Lebanon, 5 entrees from Vietnam, Japan, Thailand, Korea, and Myanmar, formerly Burma, and 6 desserts from Liberia, Ireland, Brazil, Vietnam, and France. To wash it down, visitors had horchata, a traditional cinnamon rice beverage, and Jamaica, a hibiscus tea drink, both from Mexico. After organizing, college students work with Sodexo, Co's on-campus dining service, to determine how to translate family recipes with imprecise measurements such as a can or metric measurements into recipes that can be made for the masses. "It's very hectic," said Tran, president of the International Club and an international banquet organizer. After food supplies come in, students spend an entire day making the food together, paying particular attention to serving size with recipes to ensure enough food to go around. "Some students eat more than others," Adiwal said. "We have to figure out how many people it would actually serve." Over time, the process has gotten more efficient. In past years, former international student advisor Deanna Job, who served from 1980 to 2014, said the preparation took much longer. Working side by side with students, preparing food into the night for 3 days, provided many fond memories and a lot of laughs, Job said. "I'm so proud. This is one of the most long-lived traditions at Coe College. It is a tribute to all the international and American students who work to keep the banquet going year after year." Tran, a senior in accounting and data science from Vietnam, chose to make Che Thai, a Vietnamese fruit cocktail that incorporates tropical fruits and coconut milk. With a full spring in February and March, she was setting her sights on the advent of warm weather. "Usually it's served on ice over the summer," she said, "before the April 7 banquet. I was expecting it to be warmer." Adiwal, a junior studying biochemistry and psychology, chose a couple French dishes for dessert. Although she grew up mostly in Nigeria, she thought creme brulee and meringue cookies reflected a part of her culture that would be manageable in the heat of a busy event on Sunday. While Nigeria is one of Africa's English-speaking countries, its proximity to Francophones is inescapable. For many years, she dedicated her time to learning the French language and culture. Creme brulee has an endearing symbol of the experience. "Growing up, we had a dish similar to creme brulee. It was a custard that was less sweet," she said. "When I got to the U.S., everyone told me I should try creme brulee." A few dishes were more familiar to the Eurocentric palate of Iowa, even from abroad. Twisted donuts from Liberia, palate cacio and uovo with fried eggs, cheese and breadcrumbs in a tomato sauce from Italy, and 15s, a tray bake with marshmallow and cherries from Ulster, Ireland. Others on the menu challenged the American palate a bit more, but in delicious ways. Farouda was served as an ice cream treat with rose syrup, vermicelli, and sweet basil seeds in an homage to Pakistan. Recipes for all the food served at this year's international banquet are available online at co.edu/academics/majors/area/study/Asian studies/clubs/organizations. This summer, international students plan to release a recipe book of the dishes that they served over the international banquet's last 50 years. After serving and tasting food from across the world, listening to each other call home in their native tongue, and soaking in the culture through various presentations, international students have realized one thing. They're more alike than they are different. These events are a way to show our representation and that we are actually very diverse. Khan said, "It's a safe place to express ourselves and share our culture. It's a safe place to say this is something I really enjoy, and I'd like to see if you enjoy it too." Tran, who has no close relatives in the country, has found solace in the friendly staff and students at Co. Making dishes from home, ones she can't even find in Vietnamese restaurants here, has made Cedar Rapids seem more personal. Adewaya, whose family moved to Minnesota when she was an adolescent, misses the Nigerian holidays and the way common holidays like Christmas and New Year's are celebrated. But after noticing the common ingredients and cooking techniques used from continent to continent, she noticed the people making them weren't so different either. Meeting other people from other places makes you realize how much you have in common with people from other nations, she said. We're actually quite similar. This isn't an event that simply tolerates an amalgamation of differences. It's a place that celebrates their diversity by integrating them all as one. Finishing up with a brief look at the weather, we are looking at a chance of showers today with wind out of the northwest at 20 to 40 miles an hour. The normal high for today is 59. The normal low is 36. We set a record high of 89 degrees in 1930 and a record low of 19 in 1982. Sunset tonight is at 7:44 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 6:30 a.m. That gives us 13 hours and 12 minutes of daylight. And that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, April 11, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. You can obtain a copy of today's reading anytime. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. Flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Zofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once weekly or twice monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.